Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. For many of us, it's the first type of literature we ever experience. We're introduced to them as children, but we often continue to read them in different forms as adults. If you haven't already guessed, we're talking about fairy tales, whose history is the subject of today's program. But before we take a look at fairy tales, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1970, Jimi Hendrix, guitar virtuoso and innovator of the psychedelic rock movement, died in London at the age of 27. Born Johnny Allen Hendrix to a gardener and serviceman, the young Hendrix taught himself how to play left-handed guitar. Inspired by guitarists from Christian blues to rock and roll, Hendrix was determined to one day blend those various styles into what has become known as psychedelic rock. Upon his discharge from the Army in 1962, Hendrix moved to Nashville and began accompanying established musicians such as Little Richard, Ike and Tina Turner, and Jackie Wilson. By 1965, he was ready to make his own name in the music industry. In his band, Jimmy James and Blue Flames, Hendrix became known for his sexual posturing and eccentric musical style on stage, at times playing the guitar behind his head or with his teeth. However, as his career progressed, his on-stage antics, too, often spilled over into his private life. In 1970, while on tour in London, Hendrix overdosed on sleeping pills. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, many Americans are claiming that the Taino Indian tribe is not extinct, as they long believed, having been decimated by Europeans over 500 years ago. In fact, they say they are Taino descendants. While many food and other cultural symbols of the Taino remain, the people who carry on the culture have not been heard from until now. And because of this lack of historical continuity, many experts are skeptical. Luis Martinez Fernandez, an expert in Caribbean history from Rutgers University, says that alleged members of a culture can't simply reclaim it 20 generations later. Others, however, like anthropologist Anne Britton, ask how experts can say a culture is extinct when they're standing there right in front of you. And Emerson Emery of Dallas, Texas, is researching the roles of black soldiers in the Civil War. However, these soldiers were not Union cavalrymen. They fought for the South to preserve that way of life. While Emery's research is causing controversy among both white and black historians, North and South, history buffs like Charles Kelly Barrow of Georgia tend to agree with him. Certainly, thousands of blacks fled the South to oppose slavery on the Union side. Nonetheless, many blacks stayed behind and fought for Confederate ideals. While both Emery's and Barrow's research is compelling, several historians point out the possibility that many blacks stayed behind out of fear or the expectation that the Union would prevail. You're listening to Talking History.
In dreams you will lose your heartache.
Fairy tales are usually associated with childhood, but they're not merely childlike stories. Scholars insist they serve as an important cultural mediator between children and the real world, but they have real social, political, and cultural impact. Here to explore the subject of fairy tales in history is Talking History's Eileen Dugan and her special guest, Jack Zipes.
Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, Pinocchio and the Little Mermaid. The characters of the classical fairy tales are as familiar to us as old friends. As children, we met them through bedtime stories and Disney films. As adults, we encounter them yet, with Peter Pan selling us peanut butter and fast Mercedes cars. But where did these stories come from? Why do they appeal to us throughout our lives? With us to discuss the history of the fairy tale is Dr. Jack Zipes, professor of German at the University of Minnesota. Over the past 20 years, Professor Zipes has produced a series of books and articles on the subject of fairy tales. His most recent book is When Dreams Came True, Classical Fairy Tales and Their Traditions. Welcome, Dr. Zipes.
Thank you very much.
What is a fairy tale? How would you define a fairy tale?
Well, I think I would have a lot of difficulty giving you one definition of a fairy tale, since it's changed so much. The literary fairy tale, what we generally refer to as a fairy tale today, developed as an appropriation of a particular oral storytelling tradition that gave birth to the wonder folktale. And I generally make a distinction when I write, and many other people do, between the oral wonder folktale and the so-called Zaubermärchen, which is a German term, or magic tale, or the Conte Merveilleux, or the Conte de Fées, which would be the literary fairy tale. And the literary tradition is a more modern development. It began sometime in the late Middle Ages when writers of different countries began collecting and writing down and adapting these oral tales that existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and go back. The pre-Christian, there's a pre-Christian oral storytelling tradition. And over the years, up into Europe, into the with regard to the Western tradition, these tales were spread, disseminated among different classes, and they were eventually written down in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, and that began the literary fairy tale tradition.
And what are the basic elements of a fairy tale?
Well, there are many different motifs and topoi and characters. Essentially, there is a book, a very useful book, called The Morphology of the Folktale by Vladimir Propp. He was a Russian formalist, and he outlined 31 basic functions that constitute the formation of a paradigm, which was very common in Europe and North America, and still is. And the plot of a fairy tale generally involves a protagonist who's confronted with an interdiction or a prohibition which he or she violates in some way. And then there's generally departure or banishment, and the protagonist is given a task. And the task is extremely important because the protagonist can't do it by himself or herself and needs, and here you get the number three, which continually comes up in fairy tales, needs three helpers of some kind or three gifts, accomplishes that the task, but then there's a sudden fall in the fortunes of the hero, which can be a male or female. And then, once again, there's a series of three helping events or three uses of a gift, and the conclusion generally is marriage or wealth or both or just happiness of some kind. And that's sort of the common plot structure of most literary fairy tales up to the present. But I must add that writers, great writers, have used that formula or that conventional paradigm in very, very sophisticated ways and have broken the rules and the conventions and so on. But that's, you always get a hint that that structure's there somewhere.
And you mentioned that they appear in all classes. What purpose do fairy tales serve within a society?
Well, in the oral tradition, they generally, there were two currents. One was to bring people together and to create a sense of harmony, a sense of community, and to reaffirm rituals which existed in these societies, which I generally call as pre-literate or non-literate. And some of these tales, however, were not always, did not always affirm the society. Some of them were critical in the oral tradition. So that's the tendency, the social purpose in the oral tradition. Quite often, the tales, depending on the situation, will be very critical of the ruling classes, of the aristocracy, and there would always be a dream of taking over power, turning the world upside down, you can see in certain oral folk tales. In the literary tradition, there's a shift, because when writers began writing down these tales, they appropriated these motifs and used the motifs and the topoi and the characters to address another audience, an upper-class audience, and an aristocratic audience, a bourgeois audience. And the writers, depending on their situation in the given society, would be either very critical. A lot of fairy tales have a strong ideological and political content. Or some of them would basically, again, reaffirm the status quo.
And how has the role of women changed in the course of fairy tales?
Well, immensely, although sometimes I wonder whether there's not some type of a cycle of some kind, because there are folk tales, oral folk tales, that were told mainly by women in gatherings where women would come together as spinners, as seamstresses, or as women who worked in the fields, or they some tales developed around certain cults that pertained mainly to women. And a lot of those tales, what we can make out of them, if we can, they've been gathered in the 19th century, but they probably stem, they probably go way back. But you see signs that these tales were extremely feminist in the modern sense, in that they affirmed rituals that enabled a young woman to have a good sense of herself, whether it be as a seamstress, as a worker in the fields, or whatever. They were very, very, in quotes, pro-woman, or the autonomy of a woman. A lot of these tales were, by the way, gathered by the wonderful British feminist Angela Carter, who produced two collections of folk tales showing women playing very strong roles. However, in the literary tradition, and to a certain extent in the oral tradition, as the church came into power in the Reformation period in Europe and also in North America, the tales were portrayed more and more women as catatonic, or women who had to be domesticated. They were a threat to society. And there was a negative image of women, I would say, up through World War II. And it was only in the period of beginning in the 1960s, with the rise of the anti-war movement and feminism and the civil rights movement, that a lot of writers, mainly women, but also a fair number of men, began questioning the stereotype of you know, the catatonic, complacent woman who should be satisfied with her role in the household. And today, there are remarkable tales, feminist tales, which contest the portrayal, the depiction of the stereotypical catatonic or passive woman. And there is literally a fight or a discourse, a conflict through the fairy tale about what the role of the woman should be in society today.
So what would they do with, for example, the story of Sleeping Beauty?
Well, there's a wonderful tale by Jane Yolen, a contemporary writer, called Sleeping Ugly. There's another tale by an Irish writer, Martin Waddell, called The Tough Princess, who awakens a sleeping prince. There are many different variations nowadays, but most progressive writers, male and female, generally would question that whole story of Sleeping Beauty. It does not go down well in the feminist movement.
Well, another female character who's much loved in fairy tales is the Little Mermaid, and I thought it was very interesting how you discussed the Little Mermaid and the other stories of Hans Christian Andersen in the context of his life. Can you tell us a little something about that?
Yes. Of course, I have to begin with the preface. I discussed that, the Little Mermaid in terms of Hans Christian Andersen, and to a certain extent with regard to the Disney film, which generally reflects a more contemporary conventional view, similar to Andersen's. That is, for the most part, the woman is supposed to mutilate herself for the love of a prince. And what I tried to show in my analysis of Hans Christian Andersen, that there was a certain misogynic tendency in his writings, and that in the Little Mermaid, he has this woman more or less lose the capacity to talk and to walk, or when she walks, it's extremely painful, and that he is a very strong sadistic side to Andersen's writings that I think one has to take very seriously. And a lot of the films or adaptations even up today take this motif and continue it, not as perhaps as sadistic as Andersen. And of course then there's some filmmakers or some writers who again reverse this, like the film Splash is a wonderful comment on Andersen. It's much more progressive in the stance that it takes for the mermaid, who then gets caught up in our contemporary postmodern society.
And of course, it has a happy ending.
Yes, but providing that the young man dives into the water and can breathe.
Well, we hope so. We don't want Tom Hanks drowning. What about Hans Christian Andersen and his life and his relationship with the court? How can we see that in the little movie?
His life is very sad in contrast to the film version that we have of his life with Danny Kaye portraying this very cheerful, wonderful young man, somewhat melancholy, and somewhat of a dreamer, but definitely in a positive way. Hans Christian Andersen was someone who came from a dirt poor family and left this little city, little town of Odense, and then went to Copenhagen and eventually was quasi-adopted by a well-to-do family, but always felt that he was being humiliated and always wanted to shine in the eyes of the upper bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. And he literally would lick their boots, do anything to make a name for himself, and hated himself for doing this. And you see throughout his writings, and also if you follow his life and read his diaries, he was a very pathetic man, despite the amazing success that he had, because he toadied. He literally was a toady to the aristocrats and was a freeloader and was also very vain. And some people would run when they saw him coming because they couldn't stand the fact that he would probably just talk about himself most of the time. And he was not unaware of his problems. And they really, if you read his complete fairy tales, also his novels, people don't realize he wrote many plays, novels, poetry. He was a very prolific writer, and his great dream was to become a success in the theater rather than through the fairy tales. He least expected that he would achieve almost immortality through his fairy tales. And that's the ironic part about his life, is that in the works that he did not think most of, to a certain extent, that he owes his fame to these fairy tales.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today.
Well, I'm sorry about that, and maybe we can continue this conversation some other time. Fairy tales never end.
No, they don't. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zeitz.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Professor Jack Zeitz of the University of Minnesota, author of the book, When Dreams Came True, Classical Fairy Tales and Their Tradition.
Those poor unfortunate souls, so sad, so true. They come plucking to my pocket, crying, "Sell this to please," and I help them.
Yes, I do.
Now it happened once upon a time. Someone couldn't pay the price, and I'm afraid I have to break them across the globe.
As we just heard, fairy tales aren't simply childlike stories. They have real meaning and purpose for us as children and adults.
But has a fairy tale ever been written with hidden meanings from and allusions to the time in which it was composed? Maybe so in the case of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, written by Lyman Frank Baum 99 years ago. Here to explore that subject in our op-ed of the week is David Parker, professor of history at Kennesaw State University. Professor Parker is the author of The Rise and Fall of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz as a Parable on Populism, which appeared in the 1994 volume of the Journal of the Georgia Association of Historians.
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum is one of America's favorite children's books. It's a fun story, but we also like it because we can find lessons there. The importance of following your heart, the value of friendship, and, of course, there's no place like home. In 1964, Henry Littlefield, a history teacher at a New York high school, proposed another way of looking at The Wizard of Oz. You can see all sorts of allusions to Gilded Age society and politics in the book, Littlefield said. The Wicked Witch of the East, for example, was the Eastern industrialist and bankers who controlled the common people, the little people, the munchkins. The Tin Woodman was the industrial worker, dehumanized, made heartless by the toils of industry. The Scarecrow was the Midwestern farmer. The Cowardly Lion, William Jennings Bryan, populist presidential candidate. The Yellow Brick Road, with all its dangers, was the gold standard. Dorothy's Silver Slippers represented the populist solution to the nation's economic problems. Remember the free and unlimited coinage of silver? The Wizard, able to be everything to everybody, was any one of the Gilded Age presidents. The Wizard of Oz was no longer an innocent fairy tale. It had become a parable of the populist, an allegory of their failed efforts to reform the nation in 1896. Other scholars took the notion and ran with it. One suggested that Toto, Dorothy's faithful dog, represented the teetotaling prohibitionist, an important part of the populist political coalition. And anyone familiar with the Silver Rite slogan 16 to 1, that is, the ratio of 16 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold, would instantly recognize Oz as the abbreviation for ounce. The list goes on and on. You get the idea. You'd be hard-pressed to find anything in The Wizard of Oz that doesn't have a Gilded Age analogy. Educators used Littlefield to teach Gilded Age American history, and it started showing up in college-level textbooks. The theory was perfect for the times. People in post-Watergate, post-Vietnam America were fascinated to learn that their favorite children's story was something of a subversive document, an anti-establishment fairy tale. By the 1980s, it had become the standard line on The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The theory is so beautiful, so much fun, one hates to spoil it, but Littlefield supporters seem unaware of other perspectives in the book. Scholars have described it as a feminist tract, a psychoanalytical guidebook, and, most damaging to Littlefield, a celebration of the urban consumer culture of the turn of the century. William Leach is the biggest proponent of this last view. He argues that the book, far from being a critique of industrial capitalism, glorifies the opulence and magic of the American metropolis. The Wizard of Oz was popular, Leach explained, because it met the ethical and emotional needs of people living in a new urban industrial society. 35 years ago, Henry Littlefield looked at The Wonderful Wizard of Oz and saw things no one had seen before. More recently, William Leach has shown us another way of looking at the book, a way that emphasizes a very different aspect of the Gilded Age. The two arguments are equally compelling, equally impressive. But even more impressive is the achievement of L. Frank Baum himself. In the preface to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, Baum stated that he wanted to write a new sort of children's story, a modernized American story. He was tremendously successful, producing not only the first real American fairy tale, but one that showed American society and culture in all its wonderful diversity and contradictions. A story so rich it can be, like the book's title character, anything we want it to be, including, if we wish, a parable on populism.
You've been listening to David Parker, professor of history at Kennesaw State University. This is Talking History. The story of illegal drugs in the United States is no fairy tale, but it is a story we should know. Now there's a place that explores that history, the history of illegal drugs in America, and it is the U.S. government's newest museum. Here to tell you about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The United States government's newest museum is about dope. It's about the history of America's addiction and the history of the Drug Enforcement Agency. The Drug Enforcement Administration Museum and Visitor Center, located in Arlington, Virginia, features scores of photos and a fair amount of drugs and drug paraphernalia. The permanent exhibit, Illegal Drugs in America, A Modern History, is a graphic reminder that America's love-hate relationship with intoxication goes back a long way. The exhibit is a 150-year chronological tour, and it reminds us that the Civil War, not Vietnam, produced the first addicted veterans. The museum is also a reminder of a war that has not yet been won and may never be won.
As part of our weekly coming attractions, we suggest you go west, young men and women, and join a cattle drive in Fort Worth, Texas. As part of its 150th anniversary, the city has initiated the drives to celebrate its cow town past and to evoke images of life on the dusty trail over a century ago. The city-operated program offers daily cattle drives through November 15th, but call the Stockyards Visitor Center in Fort Worth for more specific information. And if cattle drives are not your thing, try Einstein Revealed, which airs on PBS on September 21st. The Nova special shows that Einstein had more on his mind than space and time, like cheating on his wife. But oddly enough, experts on the show suggest that his rather messy personal life actually helps explain his extraordinary creativity. Interested? Check your local listings for Einstein Revealed. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we'll talk about overrated and underrated people, places, and events in history. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Let's see who the princess
was. The princess you?
And she fell in love.
Was it hard to do?
It was very easy. Anyone could see that the prince was charming. The only one for me.
Was he strong and handsome?
He was big and tall.
There's nobody like him. Anywhere at all.
Did he say he loved you? Did he steal a gift?
He was so romantic. I could not leave him.